When I was asked to do this, I haven't written very much or done very much in education, but I thought, well, I have grown up in Oxford, and I've just come back to Oxford, and now I've come back with kids who are going into the schools, well, I did, and so I have a participant observation of what's happened over a generation, or what it feels like has happened. Now, clearly the problem with that is that I've got a lot posher, which, well, I don't speak like I spoke. I did speak normal as a child, and if you go to university, which I did, which wasn't normal, at 18, and you stay in them, you speak different and different and different. So there's going to be some bias in what I say, and I'm going to show you some stuff from around the world, so I'm not concentrating just on Oxford, and I haven't got a lot of data about Oxford, it's anecdotal. I think what matters most for places like Oxford and for poverty is what's happened to Britain as a whole over the last 30 or 40 years. The reason for showing you the wine glasses in the top corner is the idea that we've had a society which has kind of poured the wine or the champagne down and there hasn't been enough. Britain, of all our spending on secondary schools, public and private, a quarter of it goes to just 7% of children who go to the private schools. Only Chile spends a higher proportion on the smaller number of children. There are other OECD countries which spend the most on the children who need the most. We are a very, very strange country. Mainland Europe doesn't do this. The rabbits. If you can read, you can read about the rabbits there. Wind in the Willows wasn't about Oxford. It was about somewhere a bit further up the Thames. But I felt as a child when I was reading this, that this stuff about stoats and weasels and the rabbits being the mixed lot and the squirrels kind of described attitudes in Oxford. And even then, there were differences, but they're much, much wider now in some ways. There was always a suspicion that the county, which was in charge and still is in charge of education, I think, the county was a little bit embarrassed by the city. Didn't quite like it. I mean, as I'm saying, this is my perception as a child. So, you know, if I knew this as a child, whether it's true or not is interesting. The city schools were problematic. They were the ones that were slightly embarrassing, some of them. They didn't get the right results. Whereas the schools outside in the county were slowly doing better and better. And this was all before league tables. That was my kind of impression. And there was a worry about where people were and would they revolt and so on. And you can get very obsessed as a child growing up in Oxford, who's very precocious. If you read loads of children's stories, Narnia is a great one, where the children go off to boarding school and come back in suits and ties and rule over the animals and so on and so on. Okay, let me tell you where I'm from. I was born somewhere down here, went to school in Donington, lived by Cowley Centre. But when I was six, I moved up around here. I went to school here. Then I went to Headington Middle, which was then a middle school, which is now Wimble Primary. I went to Cheyne. I'm going to try very hard not to upset people, embarrass people. Coming back 40 years, it's really interesting which schools have kept their names and which ones have been made to change their names and so on. So that's my little route through Oxford. My mum was a teacher. My granddad was a teacher up in Leeds and Scunthorpe. My mum taught before I was born at whatever Cheyne was. Moved around, ended up teaching out there at Lord Williams in the kind of green fields. And it's interesting you talked about rural poverty earlier. Because, of course, rural poverty exists, but it gets hidden in this map. This is the government's official deprivation index map. So if an area is red, it's poor. If an area is green, it's pretty affluent. If you grow up poor here, you have problems with rural poverty, but you'll be going to a school which in general is considered better. Personally, I'm particularly happy the schools I went with, but that's something else we can talk about. And I also think as a child I'd have done pretty badly if I'd gone to posher schools than the one I went with, because I was slow. I didn't learn to read till I was 8. I had a reading age of 9 when I was 16. The brilliant thing about heading to middle was it was mixed ability, no setting. Age 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. That's great if you're a slow boy. The 11 plus would have killed me. Private school would probably have killed me, to be honest. But Of course, as you can probably tell, I was not a poor boy. I was one of the posher ones who ended up in Cheyney. In my year, as far as I know, the 300 of us, most people left at 15, actually in the Easter, not at 16, back then. 21 went on to the sixth form, maybe a few more. The majority who went on were going to do the secretarial course in a little annex, which were all the girls. Of those of us who did A-level, six of us went to university. Five of the six were middle class. One was on the edge. That was the reality of 1970s, 80s, comprehensive education back then. If you're wondering about this bit, thinking how on earth can Christchurch be so poor, it's the effect of the homeless hostel and a few other places down there, but it isn't that poor, it's where the government starts going wrong. But this does actually have the highest mortality rate in Oxford because of Simon House. I've written a little bit about growing up in Oxford, and particularly about that Green Road roundabout. And I'll show you again in a bit. And this was about after 10, 15 years of doing social science research, and I was just thinking, is this getting anywhere? Are we learning anything? And I saw this graffiti in the subway when I was coming home back to Oxford. This is, I think, from Newcastle. Where some kid had just sprawled these arrows pointing to, and they got all the estates exactly correct over which entrance you went down and came up, determined what your chances were later in life. And I do think children have a very, very good idea about all of this. You know, maybe even better than their parents, because the children actually experience the mix, whereas their parents don't as much. So that's the Green Road roundabout, and it's nice in terms of, you know, if you wanted to grow up somewhere with a whole set of different colours, there aren't that many places, actually. There are quite a few in London, but there aren't that many in Oxford. And this is where I played, and this is the bit I knew, and I got as far as Northway when I was about 7 or 8 on my bike. The children I now teach, and have taught ever since I was 21 in various Russell Group universities, have largely come from places like this and further out. Twee, Green, a sort of stereotype, but that's their normal experience. And we are, of course, just here, in the heart of Deep Green. And here, if you're going to stereotype about Oxford, here, if you live here, the question is which private or public school, essentially. That's the one. Can you afford the Dragon? You may just about, particularly if you're a lefty, consider Charwell. But the idea of sending your child on the bike up there, let alone to Spires, you were talking about your school. So, and I, as I say, as a child growing up in Oxford, I wasn't that aware of your school. I was aware of the others, because even though I was actually baptised and I think confirmed a Catholic, by the time I was 7 or 8 we got rabbits, and that meant we had to clean them out on a Sunday and not go to church. Anyway, enough about me. Okay, let's go out of the world a bit. Before we lament too much and say how terrible it is, this is a world map of how much is spent on primary schools. Okay, just to say we are very fortunate, we're very rich. And schools are much better and teachers are much better than they were. This really annoys me. You could show it with numbers, but I just think, I liked a lot of my teachers, but they included a lot of demobbed men coming to the end of their career who'd been given these jobs in Oxford schools because they came back from the army and there's nothing else for them to do. And that cohort of people, you know, it's so obvious that teachers got better. I won't say any more about that if you want to. The other thing worth saying, this is a world map of the disparity between funding primary schools for boys and girls, just to show you how much more funding, of course, in India there is for boys than for girls and so on, and those differences. All of that was commonplace in the past. My granddad, all his sisters left school to work in the mill. He was the only one who got out and got to grammar schools. The 11 plus was rigged against women. It's an incredibly recent thing, these changes. So I don't want to sound too pessimistic to you and to show some world maps. We are strange and getting stranger. This is how much the 1% take In the USA, it's actually, this is out of date now, it's now heading over 20%, which is 1% taking 20% of all income. That leaves, for the other 99%, that leaves just 80%. It's as if the USA was a country that was that much poorer. In the UK, we're heading up to, it's about 15%. The rest of Europe, and I haven't got it here, but Japan and so on, and Korea, the rich are far, far less rich. I'll show you later, in Switzerland, the top 1% in Switzerland take half as much as they take here. And if you want to understand why we have such an expensive private school system, why we have such a divided housing market, so in a sense you're paying Dragon School fees to live in the Charwell catchment in parts of it and so on. All of that is because of our incredibly unequal income distribution, as we're getting more unequal, that makes it very hard for people to end up living together in a more mixed way. I'm going to talk very briefly about social mobility, educational mobility. Comes from here. I think one of the biggest mistakes in the 1970s, when they had this incredible transformation, it was really, really quick to get the 80% of children going to comprehensives. It's all very English. The word comprehensive was just stupid. They should have called them high schools. I don't know. If you'd call it high schools, like in America, you wouldn't have the kind of backlash that you've had since. This is a similar graph from before. Here's you got unequal countries. Brazil's very unequal, but in the States, the richest 10%, I think, take about 16, 17 times more than the poorest 10% of income. These countries are more equal. This is income mobility, so it's your chances of you having a good job depending on your parents having a good job. And the countries with the biggest income inequalities have the lowest social mobilities, for obvious reasons. People with money are very scared of their children dropping down in a country where the job is a long way down. In a more equitable country, I have three kids. I don't worry about the ones, I don't know which one's going to do well and which isn't. The big worry, and you can have too many numbers, stats, is that we know that the rate, and my kids are young, youngest is 12, the oldest is 12, one of them, odds on, will have some mental health problem that will be very serious in their 20s. That's actually what the chances are. I'm not worried about my other two children. I don't know which of the three will find life hard, but poor one probably will. And if I was a really good parent, we wouldn't have moved to Oxford. We'd have moved to Sweden, or Finland, or Denmark, or somewhere else, where for whichever of my three children finds life hard, doesn't do what you're supposed to do, the normal jobs, the decent jobs, are paid twice as much, the society's better, and so on. This is becoming more of a kind of winner-takes-all society, where if everything goes very well for you, you'll be okay. But if it doesn't, you'll be blamed for your own failure. It'll be your fault, and you know, job seekers' allowance is very low. The green colours are interesting, because there, I'm afraid the reference has come off the edge, but the green countries are ones where the education system is said to have actually helped things and made things better, given the context. And we're one of them. Germany isn't, because Germany still has something akin to 11 plus system, but even slightly worse, and it kind of involves interviewing parents to see whether your child is the right kind, and so on. Lots of Germans like it a lot. Whether they will continue to like it, I don't know. But the US and the UK and the Canadian and the Danish systems are said to be more progressive, and by this, the Norwegian isn't. Let's show you a couple more maps of Europe, and then I'll zoom on so I finish on time. This is a population map of Europe where we stretched the continent so that this is London, this is Madrid, this is Paris. So you see where everybody is. And most of my work for the last 20 years has been stretching maps and this kind of thing. This is where people are most likely to have gone to university if they're living there. That's the red areas, there's Paris again. But here, it's actually increasingly people who've come in. So increasingly our migrants from overseas are university educated. And I haven't got a map for you, but the most common two qualifications to have in Britain, still, by area, either a degree, there's whole swathes of Britain where the largest number of people by qualification have a degree, rather than A-levels, GCSE, whatever. And the second most common qualification in Britain still is no qualifications, in the areas where the most common is none. And that's more older people. who had left school without, all older my generation, all those people who left at 15 from my school. Perhaps the most interesting thing I can tell you is that since 1991, we've been becoming more equal and we haven't noticed it. The Institute for Physical Studies published a report in June and it's hidden towards the end. And it's true as long as the we is 99%. So, and this is quite incredible. It's for somebody, I should have known this, but I didn't. In the 80s, we all divided, okay? The top fifth shot off the bottom, and we divided in the 80s. But when John Major came in, from then onwards, there was actually hardly any movement for 99%. And in fact, now, in the last 3 years, the 99% have become slightly more similar in income. So all the growth in inequality for the last 20 years has been 1% lifting off. And that's only slowly being realised. To be in the 1%, you need a household income of 160,000 if you want to check. That's if there's two of you and you've got no kids. If you've got a kid, you need a bit more to join. But that's the 1%, 160,000. And I thought I'd mention it because most of the 1% are in London. But if they're not in London, it's here. It's here. And increasingly, because how on earth, you know, have you ever wondered why the Oxford house prices are doing what they're doing at the top end? It's not all inherited wealth. Some of it is people getting mortgages based on their incomes. And part of the attraction of people coming in living here who do not work in the universities or the hospitals is they're here for the schools, for their children, and then they go to London to work, or the Cayman Islands to work, because Heathrow's nearby. And all of this does matter for Oxford. I put some figures down here, too small. The average household income in Britain is only just over £10,000, because lots of households consist of just a pensioner or somebody else, or a lone parent and a child. It's actually £10,000. It's lower than the average full-time wage. £20,000 is what we normally think of as average. And then if you think about a household with 40 and with 80, those are the kind of divisions we now have in Britain. Those kind of divisions between people. And that really does divide our children up. And I think it creates all kinds of problems. When I returned to Oxford a few months ago, the local news was about the exam results for, now is it Oxford Academy? What is Piers called now?
Yes.
Okay. The best results ever, and they'd gone up, and they were better. And I remember looking at them going, but they're still very, very low compared. And I can remember the Cheney's results 10 years ago, the GCSE passes, and I thought they're not as high as those. The school here, which was Bayswater Middle, is now a primary. Yeah. And just, it feels like the divisions have grown in Oxford. I mean, that's all I'm going to say without numbers, but it feels like the exam result divisions, the desperation of parents. Okay, things were less desperate then because we didn't have league tables and people didn't know or worry so much. And the league tables helped create the divisions, which then created a house price movement apart and so on. People with right to buy to council houses in the areas, which then makes it worse. But my perception is that the divisions in this city have grown dramatically wider since I was a child. It's just hard to prove it, partly because there isn't much data from the 70s. Let's skip health. The 1%, this is how much the 1% in the UK got every year. When I was a child, the 1% got 6%, six times average income. After tax, it was 4. So it means bankers were getting £100,000 a year when I was a child. We were never been as equal. We didn't know it at the time, and we didn't know we were going to lose it, but we had never been as equal. The income gaps between my parents and other people's parents and where we lived and how you went on holiday, that had never been as similar as when I was growing up in Oxford then. And then after the 70s, this happened. Massive increase. This is France. Because people keep on telling you that this is inevitable and it's happened everywhere in the world. I just need to show that. The French complain about rising inequality, they're complaining about this. Right? The Japanese have an even smaller one, but they still moan about it endlessly. People hate inequality rising. And I hate even more somebody coming along and telling them that their inequality isn't as bad as our inequality. But this is us. That's us. This is Germany. Okay, so they have that slightly divisive education system, but almost no private schools. In fact, the only private school I know they've got in Germany is the one that the Queen's husband went to. And it's a school for people who are a bit slower. And here's Japan, that's the moan. And if you're interested in 1930s, that's 1930s Germany. And if you want to know how you become rapidly equal, you have the Americans impose it upon you. The Americans were absolutely scared of revolution in Japan after the war, so they took the land off the aristocracy and they turned Japan into the most equitable, rich nation in the planet. So now it's a place where people are healthiest, it has a 90% middle class, lots of things work in Japan thanks to the Americans. And here, in case you're wondering, is the Netherlands and Switzerland. And again, you can have bankers and pay them half as much, and they'll carry on working as bankers. And again, you can see I'm obsessed by inequality, but I just think this is the context. You can do a lot of things in schools, you can help and so on, but as this thing rises, all kinds of things happen. Children don't want their parents sending them to get hot dinners at school because they'll be sitting next to the kids on the free school dinners. Part of the reason why the sandwiches are increasing. So only the children of the lefties and the kids from the council estates are having the hot dinners. You know, you have to see all these kind of divisions. But I don't know, because I'm now looking at Oxford from the point of view of a parent, not from the point of view of a child. And of course, from the point of view of a child, you did spot whose granny had knitted their school jumper because they couldn't go to Shepherd and Woodward's. You know, all of that was there then. Two last slides. Stop on time, or can go a bit slower. Okay. This was a very different town. This is a really, really unusual town. And it's going to be worried about for education. It may be an apocryphal story, but a few years ago, I think it was Hefke did a study to find all the places that needed new universities. So they're trying to find places where kids were not going to university and identify places like Lincoln, and Lincoln got a new university. And of the 20 places that they identified, one, lacking universities, was Oxford. Because seen from the point of view of children's life chances, it's as if Oxford doesn't have universities from the point of view of the children of Oxford. Okay. The old and ancient one behaves in a particular and slightly odd way, and it might possibly be good or interesting if the old and ancient one became more of a finishing school for the world, because that would really upset the English aristocracy if they can no longer come. But I won't say anything more about that. Oxford's been really slow to increase its overseas undergraduates. London is now 50%. If you want to play with that idea of what happens if Oxford slowly takes more overseas young people paying £50,000 a year rather than people from Eton paying £9,000. But I'll leave that. I don't think Oxford University is ever going to be the solution to the children of Oxford. But Oxford Books, on its website, proudly says it takes 20%, or it did a few years ago, 20% of its intake from the county of Oxfordshire. When I asked it, okay, how many you take from the city, they said they couldn't work it out, right? But and Oxford Books, that used to be the university you went to, or if you were local, that was, and that's kind of gone away. So that's another example of an increased inequality for this particular city. Okay, the M40 was built, London got bigger, it was tricky, but this city is going to be used to end up being an example of things going wrong in British education in a way that London isn't, because London has the most amazing exam results because of immigration. It's quite incredible what's happening in London, although the profession likes to say it's some particular teaching program as well. You know, I thought it was Teach First or whatever it is. But all the correlations just say it's immigration. There's nothing you can do better to accelerate an area's educational profile than immigration. Often involving lots of sad things, which is fathers from Afghanistan beating their children if they haven't done their homework. So it's not necessarily good getting good exam results, but London is getting good exam results. Bristol's the other obvious one. fewer children go to university from Bristol than from Sheffield, as a total of all the children of these cities. Bristol is our biggest rich city, Sheffield, big poor city. How come fewer children go to university from Bristol? Bristol has 28-30% private schools. And if you know the arguments about the effect of that, fine for the children who go to the private schools, but the aggregate effect of carving those kids off is worse for the whole city. Sheffield, about 2%. South Yorkshire, about 1% going private. Still very, very divided, but 6 or 7 incredible comprehensives on the hill for the middle class who pay for their taxes rather than private. And the effect aggregately on the city is that Sheffield does better than Bristol. I know we should be talking about poverty, and I've got 2 or 3 minutes left, so I'll try and get to that at the end and say, but I think we need to look at the whole of society, particularly Oxford does, because if we have a second banking crisis or a run on the pound or anything happens, or a progressive government is elected in 2015 and the 1% become poorer, it's not impossible if they do, Oxford's going to suddenly have to cater for a lot more children whose parents won't be able to afford the fees anymore. This happened slightly in 2009. Several private schools became academies and, in effect, nationalised. It happened in Bristol. But Oxford needs to watch it. It happened slightly in London when the housing market crashed and parents couldn't move out in the way they normally flee, and they're putting porter cabins in primary schools. And it's just a particular thing for Oxford of... You know, that Chartwell catchment is enormous because there are so many children in the Chartwell catchment not going to state schools. But the minute they start to, that's going to... I just watch that happening. And last slide. I grew up with this sort of little constellation of schools, secondary schools. And now there's paranoia about primary schools that I find incredible. Nobody worried about primary schools when I was a kid. I'm fairly sure they didn't. My mum took us past several ones that were supposed to be very good, the one in Quarry and other ones, to take us up Titterpool Drive to the one for the estate in Wood Farm because she liked it. I mean, the idea, and you could do that in the 70s. Matthew Arnold's over on the other side, but what I haven't... I always wonder whether Oxford's small enough that it might be possible at some point in future for the schools to work better, so it's less a division between the state schools, and by better, if you want to be really radical, just call them the Oxford School. Have one. It has 5 or 6 sites, which means you can move, you want children going to the nearest site, because you don't want children scattering all across the city, but you could move money, teachers and resources around, and that might, you know, how else are you going to begin to remove this massive division between the state schools of Oxford. And I'm only saying it from the point of view of, we have a national debt as big as Greece. In Spain, the housing prices have halved. In Ireland, they've halved. Iceland's gone under. Things might be okay here. Nothing might happen. The economy might be fine. But supposing something goes badly wrong, as it's gone badly wrong all around us, what happens at the end of Help to Buy, when we stop trying to get young people to buy houses for £600,000 that are never paid back? What happens when, if there is a crash coming? And one way of dealing with this or thinking about it is, well, how would you carry on doing the secondary education of Oxford with a budget slashed by a further fifth or by a third? And you'd need a degree of solidarity between the state schools, I think. And then the last, I don't know, I think there's something quite funny in Oxford over all the way up the social scale. I find it, I'm quite posh now, I'm posher than I've ever been, but I'm largely teaching children from a background that's posher than mine. And the people I know who are teachers in Oxford, in general, are living in an area that's a bit poorer than the area of the school they're teaching in. And there does seem this incredible kind of upper thing in Oxford. Whereas in the rest of the country, teachers tend to be in the better half of society. And so, I can remember in Sheffield, when the snow came down in Sheffield, all the schools that had to shut were the schools in the poorer half of the city, because the teachers who lived in the richer part could not get to the schools. In Oxford, it seems the other way around. That's my time, that's enough. Thank you ever so much.
Thanks.